Hello, I'm Bob Everett. I am lecturer in renewable technology at the Open University.
The first question I'd like to ask you is, how did you come to be interested in energy and working around energy issues?
Well, that's a little odd, actually, because I was unemployed and looking for a meaningful job, and I saw an advert in the Hampstead and Highgate Gazette for a physicist with computing knowledge for solar heating project. And this was at the Polytechnic of Central London. I applied for it. I was the only applicant. I got the job. And I've sort of been doing that ever since.
Cool. We're sort of looking back. When you think about energy, you think about people having to go and collect water and collect wood, and they didn't take any of these things for granted. Mm. And we think now young people especially do really take energy and all that comes with it for granted. So in your opinion, how do you think we could address that?
I think people need to know more about how their energy, where their energy comes from, how it arrives. A good example is I was actually taking a photograph of a power station in Edmonton. And this is beside the canal. And I was taking photographs, and some people cycled up to me, and they said to me, "Excuse me, do you know what that factory makes?" And they had no idea that this was a power station. So the level of awareness is quite abysmal, really.
Well, what do you think we could do to make people more aware of energy use?
I think kind of open days at power stations, open days to see things. I enjoy going to all kinds of open days at sewage works, pumping stations. I've just got a book out of the library on underground London, and I'm quite fascinated by all the pipes and things that are under the ground that you don't see, and the way that various buildings, you only see the top bit. Are you, for instance, aware that Harrods has 7 floors underneath it?
No, I wasn't aware of that.
So there are all these things that we are not aware of. And in a way, these are sort of deliberately hidden. And if we were aware of them, I think we would be more aware of the infrastructure of our lives, the electricity, the sewage, the water, and we'd be more amazed.
Mm. Mm. I think so too. Talking about the ground and sort of using that as a source, what's your opinion on the future of fracking?
Well, I think it's not going to go anywhere in this country, and certainly not in Sussex. And also in America, it's not going very well at the moment because the oil and gas prices are low. So I think this is a technology which has been puffed up. And when all the investors have lost their money, it will remain in a quiet limbo for many years to come.
You don't seem that keen on fracking then. I like to touch on renewable energy a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you feel that it is cost effective, and how cost effective can sustainable energy be?
Well, it's a question of what are you going to compare it with. If you actually compare it with the true costs of fossil fuels, then a lot of it is actually very cost effective. And when you look at the true costs of nuclear power, then again, it's a lot of it is a bargain. But also there are technologies which are not developed yet. So things like tidal power, these are things which are technology is waiting to happen. And people say, oh, well, it's too expensive. But how do you know if you haven't built one or two? And it's when people become familiar with things, then they stop grumbling that it's expensive.
And you touched on a bit about nuclear power. I was wondering, what do you think is the future of nuclear power in the UK?
Downwards, I think, is probably it. The problem is they've put all their eggs in one basket of building some enormous nuclear power station at Hinkley, which will cost zillions of pounds. And the question is, how are you going to pay for it? The only people who could possibly pay for it are the state. And as long as you have an idea that this must be done by private enterprise, it is doomed. As soon as you say, well, this is something which should be, is in the national benefit and should be built by the state at current Bank of England interest rates of 0 or 0.5%, then indeed it does become economic. But whether anybody has the political nerve to do that, I don't know.
Do you feel that wind power could possibly be a solution for the future?
Yes, we haven't reached the limits of wind power installation yet. I'm amazed, actually, when I, having been campaigning for wind power for a long time, I'm quite amazed to go and stand on the seafront at Broadstairs and look out to sea and just see all these wind turbines out there. And then I unroll my sea chart of the Thames estuary, and then I'm quite amazed at how much of it has been filled up with wind turbines. But then I look out to sea and I see, well, there's still lots of sea there. And then when I look on the maps of future project areas, they just go on out onto the Dogger Bank. And then all of a sudden you realise that you've arrived in Germany, and this is now the German part of the Dogger Bank. So, yes, there's enormous potential. The problem is what to do with storing your surplus wind power, and what to do with the day, you know, on the day with no wind. But anyway, that's a problem for, you know, today's scientists to solve. And there's lots of clever people about.
You mentioned before sort of about the political side of it.
Yeah.
And I'd like to go back to that because oil is a big political topic.
Yeah.
And I think the speed at which we're using it is definitely going to run out. And some people are of the opinion that we should use it until it's all gone. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm currently baffled by the Saudi attitude of pumping it all like fury and driving the price down. Because in the past they have said, we will leave it in the ground for our children. So if you have a very short-term attitude, you want your money back quickly, you pump like fury. But the Saudis have only got limited reserves, and their own internal use has been rising. So they, as a country, will probably not have any oil to export to buy food in about 15 years' time. So if I was in charge there, I'd be very worried about that, and I'd be buying lots of solar panels. So.
Yeah. Just another question around politics. Globally, the current process of getting oil and distributing it creates inequality and poverty in the world. How might sustainable energy affect this?
That's difficult. The problem is that large energy supplies like oil or even nuclear come in great big gobbets which can be appropriated by an elite ruling class. I don't know quite what... If you look at the history of wind power, today's generations of wind turbines were originally produced by agricultural engineers in Denmark. It's they who actually set out to build viable electricity-generating wind turbines. Small wind turbine projects are perhaps more conducive to electricity cooperatives, smaller entities rather than big electricity utilities. But we have to see, really. Certainly in places like China, where they have, and India, where they have a deliberate policy to extend electrification to the whole of the country, then photovoltaics and wind power are a better bet than investing in large coal-fired power stations and then having to have thousands of miles of distribution wires.
Thank you. What policies would you like to see, or how can we go about reducing fuel poverty in the UK?
I can't really see energy policy, and particularly electricity policy, happily living with large profit-making electricity utilities. In Germany, in Berlin, there's been a move to municipalise the electricity supply. And in this country, right from the beginning of the electricity industry in the 1880s, there's been a continuous battle between those who thought that it should be municipally owned and those who thought that it should be privatised, and those who thought that it should be nationally controlled. And this has actually gone backwards and forwards over the years. So in this country, the electricity industry was nationalised at the end of the Second World War and then privatised. In all honesty, I would prefer to see it nationalised again. And then you can actually tackle fuel poverty. If you look at the history of electricity tariffs, you'll find at the moment we have this idea that electricity has a single price per unit for everybody. In practice, large users pay less. But if you look into the history, you'll see that in the 1920s and 1930s, electricity was promoted with special low tariffs for lighting to actually get it into the community. And a good reason for that was to reduce the fire risk of gas use for lighting. So here you have a social need. In other countries, for example, in India, electricity is sold to the farmers, particularly for food irrigation, at virtually nothing. In some states, it has been literally given away. So you have to say, well, is this the right way to do things? If you actually have a problem of fuel poverty, then the thing to do is to say, well, we have special electricity prices for the poor. And in India, in the past, certainly, those who could afford to pay more for their electricity, like the railways, were charged more. So we have to question the idea that electricity only has one fixed price for everybody. And certainly the farmers in this country did so when electricity was privatised. The first people who complained were the farmers, and the House of Lords put an amendment into the privatisation bill to insist that farmers would not be charged more for their electricity.
Mm. Touching on the notion of fuel poverty, well, not the notion, the occurrence of fuel poverty, a lot of people have been talking about renewable energy, especially within the local communities, being a better way of fueling electricity, even economic-wise. What do you think should be done to encourage more energy in new buildings, domestically, and even commercially?
Do you mean having more renewable energy actually in the buildings?
Yeah.
Well, this is where planning permission, things like this come in. If you want to build a new building, then yes, you say, well, yes, you must have photovoltaic panels on the roof. That's one way, but the other problem is what to do about all the existing buildings. And there are vast swathes of large factory buildings, shopping precincts, you know, shopping malls, things like this, which could take photovoltaic panels on the roof. But there's no great push to do that. Or they could be pushing harder, let's put it like that.
How do you think households could be supported to use more energy sustainably?
Well, I'd turn that around and say they should use less energy. So what we have is we need to get the building stock properly insulated, and also the low energy lighting. The low energy lighting program has worked very well. I think under the CERT scheme, something like 300 million low energy light bulbs were handed out at subsidised prices. So this is, this really shows in the electricity statistics. The current problem is getting people to insulate buildings with solid walls. And the problem really is that this has to be done in the way that the Danes did it in the 70s. You have to make it a local priority, and effectively you have to do it on a street-by-street basis. It's no good doing it on a house-by-house basis, and nor is it much good leaving it to the consumer. There's got to be push, and then we come to the issue of using district heating and waste heat from power stations. In Denmark, they had a planning law that basically said, thou shalt use our waste heat from power stations delivered to your door unless you can think of a jolly good reason not to. So the notion of consumer choice in heating fuels, I think, has to go out the window, really. This is a problem. Since the 70s, we've had the notion of everything has to be done by consumer choice, but that is very difficult when the gas supplies are actually running out. and very few people are actually aware of the DEC projections for, you know, 2050, which just show virtually no natural gas being used for heating in this country.
So if you were in power, if you were politically in power, what would your strategy be in energy?
Well, there are simple things that can be done. For example, Barking Power Station, that dumps maybe 400 megawatts of heat into the Thames. And yet it is equipped with the wrong kind of steam turbines to allow it to produce waste heat properly. The power station was built to produce electricity, and just electricity, because that was an electricity market. There was no notion, really, that the waste heat had commercial value that could be put into its the valuation of the power station. So as a result, it's been it could have been, what it needs is what's called a pass-out steam turbine, so that heat can be extracted, waste heat can be extracted at about 90 degrees centigrade from it without losing too much, wasting too much energy. And yet it has the wrong steam turbine, and nobody is going to buy a new one because it costs lots of money. So what you have is, in East London, you have people trying to distribute waste heat from this power station, but it's not taken off from the optimum point in the steam turbine. It's taken off from something that was supposed to supply hot water to the power station itself. So first of all, I would optimise that power station by buying a new, very expensive steam turbine. That would free up enough waste heat to heat pretty well all of Barking, most of Tower Hamlets, and that would demonstrate just what is possible. This is just regarded as normal in Denmark. So in Copenhagen, I think in Denmark something like 60% of the country is on district heating.
What do you think is the future of energy for London?
It's difficult. If you'd asked me 15 years ago, I'd have said, yes, we need gas-fired power stations located in London distributing waste heat. And I would have argued for converting Battersea Power Station back into a power station, for which it has prior planning consent. It was a power station, so it could become a power station again. And then I would distribute that waste heat throughout London. The problem is that British North Sea gas resources or gas reserves have been plummeting. The rate of discovery of new gas reserves in the North Sea is perhaps minimal. So what's happening is that if you want to use gas in this country, you have to go to the Persian Gulf and buy it from Qatar and sail it past Somalian pirates to get here. So I don't know. We've moved on to having less gas and more wind power. What we need is something for the day with no wind, and that may well be that is probably likely to be gas-fired power stations, which are designed to be very rapid in response. But it's difficult.
How far away do you think we are in London from being entirely powered by renewable energy?
It depends what you mean by that, because the wind farm arrays in the Thames estuary, if you just keep going out, right, they are sufficient on average to supply all of London's electricity. But on a windy day, they produce a surplus, and on when there's no wind, you need to find something from somewhere else. So it depends on what you mean by...
I mean, I suppose using energy that's completely sustainable.
Well, we're still a long way. As I say, the problem is what to do on the day with no wind. The technology that really hasn't been developed is coal gasification with carbon capture and storage. Because if you could burn coal and put the carbon dioxide under the North Sea, then that, well, it's not exactly sustainable because you've still got to burn coal, but it's not carbon dioxide, you're not producing too much carbon dioxide. The problem is that the projects to actually develop this technology have just not been, they've just really not been funded. So at the moment there is a project in Scotland for a gas-fired power station where the CO2 would be put under the sea, and there's one at Drax in Yorkshire which will burn coal.
What's the benefit of putting it under the sea?
Well, you're not putting it into the atmosphere. You're not putting the CO2 into the atmosphere. But there is actually quite a lot of work that needs to be done on seeing what happens when you actually put it in large quantities under the sea, and whether it stays there or how it migrates.
Do you think it's possible that we will completely move on to wind energy or solar energy?
I think so, yes. What's needed is development of energy storage technologies. And I'm quite amazed by the progress in all kinds of weird and wonderful things, to do with nanostructures and weird rare earths and things like that. And the production of, for example, light-emitting diode light bulbs. The light-emitting diode was first invented in about 1905, so it's taken a long time to get this technology to work. Some people, a couple of Japanese people, got a Nobel Prize for Physics last year for their work on blue light-emitting diodes. And I think that's really well worthwhile.
What are they? Could you expand a bit on that?
Well, you've seen blue light-emitting diodes on your Christmas tree.
Okay.
Before that, they came in sort of green and orange and red. The red ones, I think, came out in the 1970s. I do remember trying to buy a yellow one in 1974, and it was the right thing to try and do, but I think it was sort of about 30 years too early. but when you when you've made it a blue one, what you can do is you can coat it with a phosphor. And that phosphor is essentially the same as used in gas mantles. That technology was invented in the 1890s. So today's white light-emitting diodes are a combination of modern blue light-emitting diode technology and 1890s gas mantle technology. Right? But what happens then is you've got a very small long-lasting white light bulb. And you can... The problem at the moment is actually... Because these only come in little one-watt chunks. You stamp them out by the thousand and then glue them all together, and then you've got a bigger light bulb. But this is a wonderful technology for Africa, developed countries. If you really want lighting, then one of the more unusual statistics is that if you take a bottle of olive oil, you can burn it in an oil lamp, but it's actually 300 times more efficient to put it in a diesel generator and supply that electricity to low-energy light bulbs. So the efficiency of lighting has increased enormously, and the cost of lighting has fallen dramatically. So if you try and think back, there's a story of African university students having to walk across the city to the local airport car park to sit under the car park fluorescent lights to read their lecture notes. That is how desperate people are for lighting. And yet, LED lighting uses very little energy. Modern batteries, these are now mass-produced in staggering quantities. Small torch batteries, laptop batteries, Tesla car batteries. These are all the same things. The Tesla car runs on hundreds and hundreds of tiny little torch batteries. And I looked at that and I thought, how can they possibly be true? And yet it's to do with mass production and very, very high quality, production quality standards in the battery factory, so that you can produce batteries that will last a long time and are sufficiently reliable for you to put them in a car and hurtle them up and down motorways.
Well, what sort of legacy would you like to leave future generations around energy?
I'd like people to be informed, I think. I actually did my PhD thesis on a low-energy housing estate in Milton Keynes. And for that, we designed, I think, about 177 low-energy houses. And last year, I went back and visited one of the houses, and we talked to one of the people there, and he said, yes, well, it's nice and warm, and, the double glazing was a bit cheap, but it works well. And I worked out that in present day's terms, these houses saved £500 a year on their gas bill compared to the brand X houses in the ordinary estate across the road, like the drafty cardboard box that I lived in. So, I feel that sort of, yes, it's nice to feel that I've achieved something, and something that's demonstrated something.
You've left your legacy there. So our last question is whether you would consider yourself, when you're thinking about the future of energy, an optimist or a pessimist?
I'm neither, really. I think if you were an optimist, all the PV panels and wonderful new batteries would suddenly appear instantly. However, having talked to politicians, and I do go and listen to politicians and read all the articles, I can see the sheer quantity of wrangling and argument. And I just haven't got the stamina to do political lobbying anymore. It just goes on and on and on. But if you kind of turn around and look backwards and say, well, what has actually been achieved? And the answer is that this country's CO2 emissions have been falling. I'm amazed to find that, you know, the national electricity demand is falling, not rising. And that there are all these new technologies that people keep inventing and seem to work. So, in a way, I'm a pessimist, but I'm amazed by the inventions that creative people produce.
Yeah, that makes sense.